Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. FedEx offers fast delivery, more visibility, simple returns, and weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. population on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. With FedEx, you get picture proof of delivery, ensuring you always know where your package is. Returns are simple with packageless and paperless returns. Plus, FedEx Ground is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. So, what are you waiting for? See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
Hey, everybody, we got a great one today, you know, for a change. And this time, I mean it. Ari Berman of The Nation magazine is with us again. Ari and I discuss his new book, Minority Rule, which shows how shithead Republicans have been trying to prevent certain people from voting for years by every means possible. You know the tools. Make it harder for the wrong people to vote. Make them wait in lines. No Sunday voting. And this goes back to the beginning of our country when deals were struck in our Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia to give Southern slave states extra representation by counting every slave as 3/5 of a person. And of course, this didn't mean that every slave was given 3/5 of a vote. No, don't be silly. They counted as 3/5 of a person only for determining how many members these slave states would send to the U.S. House of Representatives. Of course, slaves didn't vote. They had no rights. Only white men with property voted. Slaves counted as property so they could vote. The white men who owned them. But every slave counted as 3/5 of a human being, so the Southern states could have that many more members of Congress and that many more electoral votes in every presidential election. Nope, the slaves didn't vote, but every slave that could be worked to within an inch of their lives was worth 3/5 of a person in calculating how many members of Congress the state was entitled to. It's an ugly part of our country's history, of course, which continues today as Republican state legislatures continue by making it harder for poor people, students, immigrants, and people of color to vote. This is an important discussion to have as we head into our all-important election. In other news, Donald Trump is on trial. It's a complicated case, but he seems guilty to me. Then again, I'm not on the jury. And they probably wouldn't have let me on with that attitude, I guess. The Supreme Court looks like it's going to delay the January 6th trial till after the election because it's going to establish some kind of limited immunity for presidents and send it back to the circuit or even district court, which will take too long. College campuses are exploding. Is it me or aren't college students there to protest if they feel our government is supporting a war they don't agree with? And yes, anyone who taunts students or any others wearing yarmulkes, that's hate speech. And they should face disciplinary action. And does chanting from the river to the sea mean you're advocating genocide? I'm not sure. Can it? I guess so. And if that's what you say you're actually advocating, then yes, you should be suspended. Because that's hate speech. But students have a right to protest. I did when I was in college, Vietnam, Cambodia. I have been speaking out since January on this podcast about the indiscriminate way that Israel has been conducting this war. Well over 30,000 killed, mostly innocent civilians. 13,000 or more children. Yes, the Hamas attack on Israel on October 7th was barbaric beyond imagination. And yes, obviously, Israel has the right to respond. But if we're supplying bombs, we have the right to have a say in how those bombs are used. And right now, that means trying to find a way to have a ceasefire. But that is easier said than done. Israel has offered a ceasefire with an exchange of hostages and prisoners. And Hamas has declined. Still, Israel needs to halt the bombing and develop secure corridors to deliver food and medical aid, but I guess that's pretty easy for me to say. Fortunately, I just host a podcast, and today we have Ari Berman, who has been on with me a number of times before talking about Republicans' never-ending quest to make it harder for certain people to vote. And that's what his latest book, Minority Rule, is all about. And it is a great one today. You know, for a change. The best way to learn a language? Immersion. Living where the language is spoken and using it every day. But if that's not in the cards this year, you can still learn a language the second best way, and that's with Babbel. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Babbel's convenient courses have helped me learn real-life conversation in German. For example, let's say you wanted to order soup with your dinner. Die Suppe würde mir auch gefallen. That means the soup. That means I would also like the soup. And that way, I get soup with dinner. Here's a special limited-time deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners, at babbel.com/franken. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/franken, spelled babbel.com/franken. Rules and restrictions may apply.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Well, I'm delighted to have Ari Berman with me because he's got a new book out, Minority Rule. And this book is really about how throughout our history of our country, right, Ari, there's been a push-pull between those who want democracy and everyone to vote and those who don't.
That's right, Al. Thanks so much for having me back on. Really excited to discuss the new book with you. And yeah, the book is about the struggle for American democracy over the last 250 years and how there's been those that have wanted to constrict democracy and there's been those that have wanted to expand democracy. And that fight has really reached a fever pitch today where we have some people who want to save democracy and a lot of people that want to get rid of it.
And you kind of go in the book through start pretty currently and with Wisconsin and then go back to the framers and really lay out what this struggle has been about from the very beginning. So let's talk about Wisconsin. Wisconsin in 2010, they had a vote where the state legislature was flipped. The governor's mansion was flipped. The Supreme Court was Republican. So they went from a trifecta of Democrats to a trifecta of Republicans. And we've been living with that since. And it's been a struggle since. Is that right?
That's right. And I talk about in the book how there's this struggle between democracy and oligarchy throughout American history. And really that America's a laboratory for both. It's been a laboratory for democracy at times, and it's been a laboratory for oligarchy at different times. And we really see that in Wisconsin after 2010, which is that Wisconsin was a state that was known for good government. It was known as a place that gave rise to collective bargaining rights for unions and Social Security and all of these progressive things. And then Republicans take over after the 2010 election and they want to get rid of all these things.
And of course, they had a history of progressive Republicans like Bob La Follette, right?
Exactly. It was really a birthplace of progressivism. Teddy Roosevelt called it a laboratory for progressive reform. So Wisconsin was proud of this history, and that was, and whether you were a Democrat or a Republican, you were proud that Wisconsin had been this laboratory for progressive reform. And then Scott Walker and the Republicans come in after 2010, and they said, we want to fundamentally change the nature of the state. We want to make Wisconsin a laboratory for oligarchy so that the government is working to benefit us and the rich corporate backers backing us. And we're either going to dismantle or rig all of these democratic institutions to make sure that we stay in power for as long as possible.
And one thing that coincides with that 2010 election is the 2010 Citizens United decision.
Exactly. So before those 2010 elections, the Supreme Court basically says that billionaires can buy elections in secret. And a lot of dark money gets funneled into...
Right before. Let's make that clear. It was just right before. It was the same year, 2010, that Citizens United decided on a 5-4 vote. Justice Kennedy writes the decision. In the decision, he says there'll be transparency, right? There'll be disclosure.
Yeah, he says there'll be transparency and money will not lead to corruption. Neither of which happened. Money led to a lot of corruption and there was no transparency. And what happened is conservative groups and donors began funneling a tremendous amount of dark money to back Republican candidates. And they did this particularly effectively in Wisconsin, where they essentially propped up Scott Walker and the Republicans' majority in Wisconsin with all of this outside funding that was impossible to trace.
Yeah. We had a Disclose Act come to the floor of the Senate. All the Democrats were for it. Scott Brown got elected and screwed up everything. We couldn't get disclosure. And it was interesting. You talk in your book about McCain-Feingold. And Feingold, of course, from Wisconsin. And they had passed... How long before 2010 did they pass?
2002 was McCain-Feingold.
Okay. And McCain-Feingold put limits on how much could be donated to elections, right?
That's right. And Mitch McConnell hated that more than anything ever. He compared McCain-Feingold to Dred Scott, which was the decision upholding McCain-Feingold to Dred Scott, which of course ruled that Black Americans couldn't even be citizens of the United States. That's how much Mitch hated McCain-Feingold. And basically what Republicans wanted to do is they wanted to change the courts so they could strike down things like McCain-Feingold and instead put in place Citizens United. And that's what happens.
Mitch McConnell, when McCain-Feingold was on the floor, said, we just need disclosure. Disclose, disclose, disclose. Sunlight is a great, great disinfectant. Then years later, when they, the Supreme Court had decided Citizens United, then McConnell didn't want disclosure, disclosure, disclosure. So we lost that one. We tried to do a Disclose Act, and the Republicans, every one of them on McConnell's instructions, and they didn't need his instructions, voted it down.
Yeah. And then what happened is all this dark money started getting funneled to places like Wisconsin. And then there was this extremely elaborate scheme where donors couldn't give money directly in these huge amounts to Scott Walker's campaign because there were still disclosure requirements at the state level in Wisconsin. So they funded it to these other basically front groups. And then the front groups coordinated directly with the candidates. And so it was like you were giving these huge donations in secret from billionaires directly to the candidates, but you were funneling them through the front groups in this really unprecedented, complicated way. And so that was one way. It wasn't the only way, but it was one way in which Republicans were able to maintain their stranglehold on Wisconsin was through all this dark money, in addition to gerrymandering, voter suppression, union busting, and the like.
Yeah, the union busting is important, but the gerrymandering was extreme to the point where they could have an election. Democrats could win the popular vote if you added up all the votes in all the districts. And lo and behold, Republicans would not just win, but almost have a supermajority.
That's right. There was a strategy that Republicans had in 2010, which was first to win back control of all these state legislatures, which they did in many key swing states.
They had one in 2010.
Yeah, they did. And then they drew the new districts after that.
Yeah. And 2010 is a key year because that's a census year.
Exactly.
And you redistrict after census years. And they were able to do that. For the 2012 races?
Yes. And so they draw these new districts. They're incredibly lopsided for Republicans. I mean, Wisconsin's a 50-50 state, but you get these incredibly lopsided districts. And what happens is Democrats win 54% of the statewide vote for the state house in Wisconsin, but Republicans get 64% of the seats. So that's wild that one party could get 46% of the votes, but 64% of the seats. That's what happened in Wisconsin. And basically it meant that Republicans were winning even when they lost, and it was essentially impossible to oust them from power once those gerrymandered maps passed.
They must have been really proud of themselves to accomplish that.
It's quite a feat. I mean, they made all sorts of arguments like this is based on the political geography of Wisconsin and yada, yada, yada. But I think everyone knew this was just politics at its most brutal. And they had transformed a 50-50 swing state to almost a two-thirds supermajority in the legislature simply because they had the power to draw the maps.
And if you look at what happened in the presidential years, for example, in 16, Hillary lost by 23,000 votes, but the state legislature, again, wildly Republican. And then in 2020, Biden won by 20,000 votes. And again, wildly Republican. So they had gerrymandered the wazoo out of the state.
Yeah, and what it does is it emboldens the Republicans to do more and more extreme things. So in 2018, Wisconsin elects a Democratic governor, Tony Evers. And the first thing that Republicans do is they call a special session to strip power from the Democratic governor before he's even taken office, which was really, truly unprecedented. But basically, they didn't want anyone to be able to challenge their power. And they said, okay, well, even if the voters had elected a Democrat, we're still going to remain in charge of the state. And it was funny because the leader of the Wisconsin Assembly, the Republican speaker, Robin Voss, said, well, actually, we are the ones who are most reflective of the voters of Wisconsin, which was hilarious because they were so gerrymandered, they didn't represent the voters of Wisconsin at all. But they felt like they were the only ones entitled to exercise power.
Wow. But now it has a good ending, or almost good ending, and will be a good ending, I think, this fall. So what happened is finally the Supreme Court of Wisconsin, which had been all this during this period, a majority Republican, finally flipped last year, right?
That's right. There was a Justice Janet Protasiewicz won, and there was a 4-3 progressive majority on the state Supreme Court. This is a result of winning a number of elections. So basically, when Democrats became very frustrated with the legislature and the lack of accountability in the legislature, they began looking to the state Supreme Court to try to act as a check on the legislature. So they elected three progressive women since 2016 to serve on that court. That gave a progressive majority on the court. And then that court struck down the gerrymandered maps that were passed by Republicans, the second round of gerrymandered maps, because they passed gerrymandered maps in 2011. Then they passed even more gerrymandered maps in 2021. The Wisconsin Supreme Court struck down those maps. And then what happened is the Democratic governor and the Republican legislature agreed on new maps, because the Republican legislature basically passed the maps that were proposed by the Democratic governor, which they never would have done if the state Supreme Court had not struck down the gerrymandered maps in the first place. So now there's real competition in the Wisconsin legislature again for 2024.
Well, Evers actually put out a fair map, like one of these maps that would be written by an independent board. So Republicans were afraid that if they didn't accept that map, then the Supreme Court would mandate a wildly Democratic map, which they wouldn't have done, probably.
They wouldn't have done, but basically what the state Supreme Court did is they hired two experts, and the two experts said, we can draw our own map, and it could have been a map that was less favorable to Republicans than the map put out by the Democratic governor. So Republicans basically took the least bad option, which was to pass the Democratic governor's map. But to anyone who's followed Wisconsin politics over the past decade, this was a remarkable event. I mean, you finally had the Republican legislature basically saying, we're going to ungerrymander ourselves because we're so afraid that the courts are going to leave us in an even worse position. I mean, it was pretty remarkable just how far they'd fallen.
It's actually really funny because Evers put out a fair map. You can adjudicate this. You can, through computer models and those kinds of things, draw a fair map. And that's what the governor did. And the Republicans said, well, we better do a fair map because the Supreme Court could give us a really gerrymandered one. We don't trust the Supreme Court as much as we trust the Democratic governor, I guess, or his map.
Yeah, and Democrats in the legislature voted against it because they thought, what are Republicans doing? They're just going
right?
to vote voluntarily. Yeah, they didn't trust Republicans. They thought, are the Republicans just going to voluntarily give up their own power? But I mean, they did. I mean, the fact is, Republicans could still have a majority.
Yeah, well, that's the whole point.
Under these maps, they're just going to have a much smaller majority that's more reflective of this fact that Wisconsin's a battleground state.
Yeah, the whole point is, yes, they could get a majority if more people vote for them. And that's sort of the point.
Exactly. Whereas before, they had a majority when fewer people voted for them, which is not the point.
And there's all kinds of dark money going through this in your book. It was very lopsided, especially at first, right? And has it evened out a little bit?
Yeah, it's evened out more. I mean, I think, you know, Democrats have gotten better at playing the dark money game, but certainly in Wisconsin, the amount of money that was going into things like state Supreme Court elections, there was dramatically more Republican money going in than Democratic money. Now there's it's kind of evened out more. I mean, it's not necessarily good for democracy because these races have become so unbelievably expensive. I mean, the last state Supreme Court race broke records on both sides. I mean, you're talking about $50 or $60 million spent on the Supreme Court election.
I think it's the most expensive races ever.
And so, I mean, I don't necessarily think that's going to be good for Democrats or progressives in the long run to try to play that game. There's, generally speaking, more conservative billionaires than Democratic billionaires. But yeah, Democrats have caught up on that front. But I think it just goes to show Republicans understood the stakes of the states earlier than Democrats did.
And I think Republican billionaires are not just slightly, but quite a bit more tuned to their own pocketbooks than your George Soros is. His whole thing is about democracy, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the Republican billionaires feel like this is going to help me, and the Democratic billionaires feel like this is going to help everybody else. So there's a little bit of a different philosophy when it comes to try to influence elections.
Every once in a while, Democrats are given a self-serving way, believe me. But let's go now to the Constitutional Convention, because the book really kind of covers all of the struggle throughout our history. You know, just go over some of the moves that were made in the Constitutional Convention that ultimately are going to make this less and less democratic as the demographics of the country changes.
Well, it's really remarkable because, I mean, we're taught from childhood to venerate the Constitution. And in many ways, the Constitution is a remarkable document, but it's also a remarkably anti-democratic document if you look at the institutions the founders created. So the president wasn't elected by the people. That's still the case today. The founders didn't trust the people to elect the president. So they created this complicated electoral college system that exists with some modifications today.
It's been very different because not everybody can vote. But all citizens can vote if they're over 18 and not in prison, I guess. In some states, in prison, they can vote, right? Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, it's very different in the sense that people vote and then the electors in the state, generally speaking, follow the popular vote in that state.
Yeah. There's direct election of senators and there's been a lot.
Yeah, exactly. So the system has been reformed, but we still have the Electoral College today. We haven't abolished it. People can directly elect senators, whereas back then senators were nominated by state legislatures and chosen by the House. So the public didn't directly elect the president. The public didn't directly elect the Senate, based on how it existed in 1787. And each state was given the same number of senators, which actually people like James Madison really weren't crazy about. They thought that was going to lead to minority rule in the Senate, because what would happen is that the small number of states would have much more representation than they otherwise would under proportional representation. And Madison worried that this was going to lead to minority rule on a much broader scale as more states were admitted into the Senate over the years and as the country moved westward. Now, that's happened on a dramatically larger scale because in 1787, the largest state, which was Virginia, was 12 times as big as the smallest state, which was Delaware. Now, California is 68, which is the biggest state, is 68 times bigger than the smallest state, which is Wyoming.
Smallest state in population, of course.
Yeah, in population. Yeah. So, I mean, what happens is small conservative rural states, whiter states, have much more representation in the Senate than larger, more diverse urban states.
Let's put in some numbers. I believe that the 51 Democratic senators represent 58 or 59% of the American public, and the 41 Republicans represent 41 or 42. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, it's just remarkable. I mean, you have a situation where the body is basically 50-50, but Democrats represent tens of millions of more people. You can talk about the numbers in so many different ways, but one of the stats that I find most chilling is that in 2024, Republicans could take back control of the Senate just by winning West Virginia and Montana, but they'd only represent 42% of the country under that situation. So they could have a majority of the Senate while representing only 42% of the country.
And this is why we have to not just admit D.C. and Puerto Rico, but divide California into eight states.
Or get a lot of Brooklyn hipsters to move to Missoula. I guess some of that's already happening, but needs to happen on a much bigger scale. But yeah, I mean, the basic problem with the Senate is how it was structured. And it's funny because you always hear conservatives say, we need to go back to the founders. We need to go back to the founding period. Well, first off, the founding period was incredibly undemocratic, but also a lot of the founders didn't like this situation that they created, this institutions they created. The biggest critic of the structure of the Senate was James Madison, who was thought of as the architect, the father of the Constitution. So I thought these debates were really instructive because there was a lot more debate than I had remembered about how we elect the president, how we elect members of Congress, how we choose the judiciary. There's a lot more debates about this in 1787. People think that there was this unanimity by the founders in terms of creating these institutions, but many of the founders had grave concerns about the compromises they were forced to make.
Now, Delaware was threatening to leave the Union.
Yeah, I mean, that's how we got equal representation in the Senate, where each state gets the same number of senators, is that basically, originally, the Senate was structured based on proportional representation. That was the plan that was laid out by James Madison. And then the Attorney General of Delaware basically stands up and tells the delegates from Virginia and Massachusetts and Pennsylvania, the largest states, that if you don't agree to give us the same number of senators, we're going to leave the Union and we're going to find some foreign ally that's going to be more generous to us. So basically saying, if you don't give us the same amount of seats in the Senate as Massachusetts, we're going to flee to France, basically, and join them. And that was a very real threat back then, that states would bolt and either ally with other countries or that they would just not ratify the Constitution itself. And so they had to make a lot of compromises. Equal representation in the Senate was one of those.
No one called their bluff.
They couldn't call their bluff because they needed enough states to ratify the Constitution. That's also how we got the three-fifths clause, which gave the slave states much more representation than they otherwise would have.
Let's talk about that, because I think there's some misunderstanding of that. I know that when a lot of people hear slaves were only counted as three-fifths of a person, that they are outraged because these are all, they're obviously whole people. But what it was, they had no right to vote. They had no rights at all. They were slaves, right?
Exactly. And what the slave states wanted to do was they wanted to get political power from people who were disenfranchised. So they didn't want to actually extend any rights to enslaved people, but they wanted to get representation because of the numbers of that.
They wanted to use the number of slaves to get more representatives.
Exactly.
And they accomplished that.
Yeah, they accomplished that. What the free states were arguing was, no, you shouldn't have that. Pennsylvania and those places that where slavery was illegal were saying, no, you shouldn't. They shouldn't count at all because they're disenfranchised. And what the slave states were saying was, okay, well, we'll leave the Union too. we'll join forces with the small states and we'll go join France or something if you don't like it. And so this complicated thing, it was kind of like the Electoral College. They worked out another kind of compromise where slaves would be counted as three-fifths of people. That gave slave states a third more representation in the House than if they had otherwise not have counted slaves for purposes of representation.
How many slaves were in states like this in terms of the relationship for the slaves population to the white male?
A lot. I mean, much greater number of slaves than there were white people in many of these states. And also, after the Constitution was ratified, places like Georgia and South Carolina imported more slaves than they ever had in their history. So, I mean, in many ways, the Constitution was a green light, because also they also put in that they weren't going to ban slavery at all for 20 something years. Now, of course, it took much longer than that, but that there was express guarantee that slavery was not going to be banned, at least immediately in the Constitution. So that led the Southern states to import more slaves to, of course, not just boost their economy, but boost their political power. I mean, they had incentives to do so. And then that also affected the presidency because remember the Electoral College is based on representation, total population, but also representation in the Congress. And because the slave states had more representation in the Congress because of the three-fifths clause, that also gave them more power when it came to selecting the president. So the government was really hamstrung from the start by two very powerful minorities, smaller states and slave states. And they had a hugely disproportionate impact on the new government.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Ari Berman discussing his new book, Minority Rule.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This episode is brought in part to you by Audible, your go-to destination for thrilling audio entertainment. Whether you're looking for a hair-raising experience to enjoy while you're on the move or eager to dive into sinister and shocking tales, Audible has an exclusive collection of thrillers from best-selling authors that will keep you on the edge of your seat. Like James Patterson's first audio-only thriller, The Coldest Case. Experience stories like never before, where every chilling detail is brought to life by captivating sound design. Plus, as an Audible member, choose one title a month to make yours forever. And now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Just visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
Let's go to some of the. I want to read a quote. This is Paul Weyrich, who was he was the first head of the Heritage Foundation.
Yeah, first head of the Heritage Foundation, key advisor to Ronald Reagan and other Republican presidents.
He's a huge figure in the Republican Party becoming what it is in terms of using every lever they can to de-democratize this country. Here's what he said, quote, "I don't want everybody to vote," he said. "Elections are not won by a majority of the people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now." This is in 1980. "As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down." That's pretty right out there. And I was astounded in your book where they say this all the time, this kind of thing. They make no secret of this.
Yeah, I mean, that is really the smoking gun quote. And it just shows how they feel about democracy, which is, if democracy doesn't work for us, then let's just get rid of it. And they're basically saying that they benefit when democratic participation is lower. And there's always been these anti-democratic forces, particularly within the Republican Party. But those anti-democratic forces have become so much more prominent. And the radicalization of the Republican Party has become so much more extreme to really threaten representative democracy itself. And the fascinating thing is that quote was in 1980, right, Al? So just goes to show you how these anti-democratic attitudes predate Trump. And it really was the feeling of Republicans that if we don't like democracy, let's just try to get rid of it, that I think led to Trump in the first place and is one reason Trump has proved so popular within the Republican Party, because he just comes out and says these things all the time. That impulse has always existed within the Republican Party. And then Trump has just kind of tapped into it.
And in Wisconsin, going back to Wisconsin for a moment, they knew this and they did everything they could to make it harder to vote. And they did it very effectively.
Behind closed doors, they basically are arguing for new voter ID laws and other things like that. And what they say is, we have to think about what this could mean for what they say neighborhoods around Milwaukee and college campuses across the state. Neighborhoods around Milwaukee is basically a euphemism for black neighborhoods. So they're basically saying
within Milwaukee.
within Milwaukee. They're basically saying we don't want black people and college students to vote. Now, they're not saying it publicly in the way that Paul Weyrich was, but they're basically voicing the same kind of sentiment that our leverage in the election goes up as the voting populace of our opponents goes down. And Wisconsin Republicans were quite surgical in trying to prevent younger people and trying to prevent communities of color from voting. That's a big reason why Trump won the state in 2016. And there's been this big battle. And I think what Republicans did in Wisconsin was they were very systematic about it. They said, okay, let's go after unions because unions are the biggest supporter of the Democratic Party. Let's go after black voters and college students because they vote for the Democratic Party.
And they got rid of public unions.
They got rid of collective bargaining rights.
Right. Yeah.
For public sector unions and other things like automatic dues. And now I saw a statistic that Alabama had a higher percentage of union workers than Wisconsin fairly recently. So that's pretty shocking how effective they were at curbing the power of these unions. And it was all about trying to defang the Democratic Party. I mean, they tried to sort of talk about it in terms of economics and other things, but it was just a raw power play. It was basically saying, these are the funders of the Democrats. These are the major organizers behind Democrats and progressive causes. And let's go after them because that's going to make the Democratic Party and the progressive movement much weaker. So it was very systematic in terms of how they were thinking about these things.
And how did they go after black voters in Milwaukee? I think during the election that took place, and I think this was a primary election in Milwaukee during COVID, they had only 5 precincts in the whole city. Do I recall that right?
Yeah, they only had 5 locations. I mean, that was during COVID, but it was still incredibly shocking. I mean, Wisconsin was the only state that didn't push back their presidential primary in April of 2020, largely because Republicans were trying to win a state Supreme Court election. That was that same election. I thought, okay, all the Democrats are going to be afraid of COVID. They won't vote and we'll win this election. That actually ended up backfiring and they lost the election because Democrats were so outraged about what they were trying to do. But yeah, there were only 5 polling locations in Milwaukee instead of 180, which would have been normal. That there was this famous sign that someone held up when she was in line for 2 hours at the height of COVID saying, "This is ridiculous." that really became the perfect summary of what was happening. There was also 2016 in which Wisconsin instituted a new voter ID law, said you had to have government-issued ID to vote, but it was implemented in such a way that there was very little outreach to black voters in Wisconsin. First off, Scott Walker and the Republican legislature didn't allocate any money to educate voters about this law. And then when they finally did allocate it, they did things like they ran ads in movie theaters across the state. But they didn't run ads in any movie theaters in Milwaukee. They just happened to allocate no money to the largest or second largest city in the state, which happens to be home to 70% of the African Americans in Wisconsin. So I think time and time again, they were doing things to try to disenfranchise those communities that they felt like weren't going to vote for them.
And that probably accounts for, as part of what accounts for Hillary's loss, but I would think probably could be said to in the entirety of the loss. There is also the third party and Jill Stein and those things.
I mean, there was a pretty good study that looked at Dane County for Madison and Milwaukee County, home to Milwaukee, after the 2016 election that was done by the University of Wisconsin political scientists. And they found that basically anywhere from 17,000 to upwards of 23,000 people were prevented from voting by the state's voter ID law. And Donald Trump only won the state of Wisconsin by 22,000 votes. So what we saw is that Democrats were more likely to be disenfranchised than Republicans, and that black voters were 3 times more likely than white voters to not possess the ID that was necessary to be able to vote. And so I think it had a big impact in the 2016 campaign. And Republicans, like I said, bragged behind closed doors that this law was going to target college students in neighborhoods around Milwaukee, and that's what it has seems to have done.
And what do they do with college students? Because I know that sometimes the college students, to have to renew your voting registration, you have to put your new address, and college students from year to year go from one residence to another very often, right?
They did this incredibly complicated thing where student IDs weren't valid, where they had to issue all new IDs. They said that ID cards have to be reissued every 2 years, which makes no sense for a 4-year in a place like the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And they also had a lot of other bureaucratic things that made it so that students couldn't just show up with their IDs. to be able to vote. So that was one way they were targeting students. There also were attempts to try to eliminate Election Day registration. If you ever go to Wisconsin on a big election, you'll see huge lines of students lined up to register and vote on the same day. That's potentially the most important thing that could be done to increase voter turnout in these states. Minnesota, of course, Al, has had this since the 1970s and is one reason why Minnesota is almost always number one in voter turnout. But Wisconsin has it too. And a lot of Republicans tried to get rid of that and mess with that as well.
Yeah, I won my first race by 312 votes. So a lot of things could have made the difference there.
Yeah, but I mean, you know how important it is. I mean, you're talking about many more than 300 people registering and voting on the same day.
Other states do this. This is why Biden said that they're going back to Jim Crow, the new Jim Crow in the South.
Because they're trying to restrict voting rights. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, the interesting thing is, if you look at the trajectory of American history, a lot of these voter disenfranchisement efforts were concentrated in the South after the Civil War, and that formed the core of Jim Crow. But a lot of the second and third generation voter suppression devices have spread to the North, and they're being done kind of regardless of geography. Basically, it's, okay, we're not going to be able to disenfranchise everyone, but let's see if we can shave 5% off the vote here or 3% here and gain an advantage in close elections. And so it's now a lot of these northern states that are major battlegrounds as well, whether it's a place like, you know, Wisconsin or Ohio or wherever, that they're kind of doing things that previously were done in the South in the 60s.
Yeah, Wisconsin and Ohio, all these changes started happening after the 2010 election. 2010 election, of course, was a landslide for Republicans because of the Affordable Care Act, which was being lied about and saying there were death panels and all that stuff. And the Affordable Care Act became a winning issue only really in 2018. It took that long after they tried to get rid of it. And when they tried to get rid of it, but for the thumbs down from McCain, people started to see what the Affordable Care Act actually covered. And they went, holy mackerel, this causes all pre-existing conditions. You don't get penalized for having a pre-existing condition. It's surgery, it's drugs. People finally realized what it was, and that's why we had a landslide in 18.
Yeah, and I mean, the thing is I think that 2010 election is much more pivotal than people realize. I think it really was the tipping point to Republicans radicalizing against democracy all across the country. The states really became their laboratory for oligarchy and the way that they would fight back against the election of the first Black president. And then because they were able to gerrymander in so many of these states, they either remain in power for the entire decade, or in many of these places, they're still in power. And that's kind of the nerve center for a lot of the radical policies that have then been adopted at the state level. And that's why I kind of argue that this crisis is of democracy is obviously, it's much older than Trump, but I think it's deeper than Trump, too, because you had the radicalization of people like Scott Walker and all these other figures in the Republican Party. The Tea Party, exactly. Yeah, but I think that was a big part of the Tea Party was these anti-democratic attitudes and actions. And that helps lay the groundwork for the kind of authoritarian leader that they're yearning for in Donald Trump.
Yeah, but Tea Party was not caused by Obamacare, but was energized by it. Because, again, we had this, there'll be death panels, they'll pull the plug on grandma, that kind of thing. And people really, I at the state fair would have to sort of calm people down and actually, I enjoyed doing this, by the way, telling them what was in it and what wasn't in it. And if you do it politely, you can go and get a long way in doing that.
Yeah. But I think that race was also a major part of the Tea Party. I mean, a lot of people on the right argue it was all about bailouts and Obamacare, but I think a lot of it was a reaction to the first Black president. If you looked at Tea Party rallies, they were overwhelmingly white. There were always these pictures of Obama as a Marxist or a socialist or the Joker. It wasn't very subtle. I have a lot of quotes in my book about, you know, people like Tom Tancredo, the former Republican congressman from Colorado, saying Obama's election is multiculturalism run amok. People who couldn't even, I think he said something like people who couldn't even read or spell English elected Barack Hussein Obama to the White House. I mean, this stuff is not, the birther movement really starts with the Tea Party. It's not really subtle. And one of the things I argue in the book is that basically as the U.S. becomes closer to a majority-minority country, a country in which white people will be the minority, that is motivating Republicans to take more extreme anti-democratic actions to try to stop the impact of demographic change. And I think the Tea Party in many ways kind of represented that and was at the vanguard of trying to do that.
This is why President Biden referred to a lot of the voter suppression that was going on in the South, the new Jim Crow. And he was criticized for that. But it was exactly the same point, was trying to reduce the number of Black people voted. And there are different ways to do that, right? They're crossing out their names because they're spelled wrong. What was that technique?
In Georgia, it was exact match, basically, that when if your name, when you register, doesn't match your exact name on your voter registration database, you're kicked off the rolls. But yeah, there was a lot of different ways in which voting rights are being restricted right now. And I think the larger point Biden was also trying to make was about the sweep of American history, right? Which is that in the South, we had multiracial democracy during Reconstruction, and they did overturn it to institute Jim Crow. And he was basically saying it's the same kind of pattern, which is that a lot of people felt threatened by Biden's coalition in 2020 because it represented the future of the country. And you look at where Trump is trying to overturn the vote in 2020, he kept saying it's places like Milwaukee and Philadelphia and Las Vegas and Phoenix. And what do all these places have in common? They're Democratic cities with large minority populations. I mean, that was where Trump was trying to overturn the vote. And then they turn around from trying to overturn the election to trying to change the voting laws in all these key swing states by going after Democratic constituencies like Black voters. No one was arguing that Georgia's law restricting voting rights was as bad as a poll tax or a literacy test, but it's a new form of it in that you're trying to reduce voter participation.
Yeah,
you're
so targeting exactly certain groups.
And there's a similar moment in history occurring.
You remember Godfrey Cambridge? I'll bet you don't. You're too young. Remember, he was this great comedian, Black comedian, and he told the story about trying to vote in his home state of Mississippi. And there, of course, they at this time had literacy tests. So first he's given the Gettysburg Address to read, and he goes, 47 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new, and they go, okay. Then they bring out a Wall Street Journal and say, okay, read this. And he says, it says Dow Jones closed down 42 points today. Like, oh, okay. Well, then read this. And it's a Chinese newspaper written in Chinese, and he says, it says, and then he uses the N-word. He says, the N-word ain't going to vote in Mississippi this year. And that's what it was.
Yeah, I mean, back in Jim Crow, it was so many ways. Literacy tests, property requirements, grandfather clauses, et cetera, backed up by widespread lynching and fraud. But I think the Reconstruction period is so instructive today because it was really the country's first attempt at multiracial democracy. It was the first time that the promise of the Constitution became real, and it was overturned so violently and quickly that it showed how democratic rights can be taken away. I mean, the quote from that President Obama always said, which was he took from Martin Luther King, which the arc of history is long, but it bends towards justice. But it's often more accurate to say that it bends towards justice and then snaps back when it's bending towards justice, that the revolution always sparks an equally committed counter-revolution. And I think we're at one of those moments today where, as we get closer to this majority-minority future, people that are trying to snap the arc of justice back are getting more and more aggressive about doing it because they feel like their time and power is running out.
One of the parts of the book I love is Chris Kobach's role in all of this. Chris Kobach is a Kansas lawyer, right?
Yeah, he's now Attorney General of Kansas. But when I introduced him in the book in 2010, he's Kansas Secretary of State.
And he's basically the guy who kind of carries that the election in 2020 was stolen, right? No.
2016. He's starting to argue that the 2016 election is stolen when Trump says
it wasn't stolen. That Hillary didn't actually win the popular vote. That's what he set out to prove.
Yes.
And she won by about 3 million votes. So Trump puts a commission together headed by Chris Kobach to prove this. So they have the wherewithal to do this. But it falls apart because for a whole bunch of reasons. One, he's kind of asking states for inappropriate things, but also because it just, there's no there there.
Exactly. I mean, they go on this, Trump says, I would have won the popular vote if 3 million people hadn't voted illegally. And people are like, what are you talking about? And even Republicans like Paul Ryan are like, what are you talking about? And he's like, oh, well, talk to Kris Kobach. He's Secretary of State of Kansas. And Kris Kobach rolls out these really debunked studies that claim to show non-citizen voting on this massive scale. Meanwhile, Kris Kobach is given power to prosecute voter fraud in Kansas, doesn't find any non-citizens who have voted illegally. They form this commission. The great hero of democracy, Mike Pence, is the chair of the commission. And they start looking for all this evidence of illegal voting. They can't actually find any because voter fraud does not exist on the scale that they're describing. And it disbands basically because there's so many lawsuits against this commission. But I argue that it's really important because, again, this is another turning point in the Republican Party radicalizing democracy. And this was really the first big lie. Trump saying that the election, that he would have won the popular vote if not for massive voter fraud.
What's funny is Kris Kobach is given the power to find voter fraud and he can't find it. I think there's one other case later. This is when he's Secretary of State for Kansas. And he finds such a small number of votes that were illegally cast, and most of them are Republican by Republicans.
Yeah, they find so few votes that are cast illegally. They basically start writing a report on illegal voting before they've actually found any evidence of illegal voting. And it's hilarious because you go back and look at the records of commission. There's just a report that says evidence of illegal voting, and it's blank because they never found any actual cases.
No, it's hilarious, the lack of evidence, because literally finding four votes and they're all Republicans is hilarious. Yeah,
but I mean, the problem is that they don't find any evidence, but it lays the groundwork for them to then make this even more ludicrous claim in 2020, which is that the election was stolen, right? So they're going from, you know, we would have won the popular vote if not for the millions of illegal votes, to now we're trying to invalidate even more votes potentially. It's just scary to the extent to which they basically have no evidence for these claims, but more and more Republicans are believing them. I think that's the frightening part of all of this.
Well, no more evidence that Trump actually lost and more Republicans believing them. And that's because
exactly
they flood the zone with shit.
Yeah, and it's like what you see in the book is that these people just keep failing upwards. Like Kris Kobach keeps losing in court, his claims keep getting debunked, and yet he's becoming a more and more influential figure in terms of the idea that when Republicans lose elections, it's because of massive voter fraud. That's now accepted by 70% of the Republican base, and that of course is then a pretext for more and more anti-democratic actions. Because if you believe that the election was stolen, well, then of course you're justified in storming the Capitol and trying to overturn the election, doing these incredibly anti-democratic things because you believe some fundamental wrong was done to you.
Or just getting rid of ballot boxes.
Or just getting rid of ballot boxes or purging the voting rolls or doing all of these other anti-democratic actions. I mean, this is now kind of articles of faith within the Republican Party, and it's leading to this even bigger battle between the forces that want to expand democracy and the forces of who want to constrict democracy, because the forces who want to constrict democracy are being more and more anti-democratic by the minute.
Because they have to. They're desperate because they can't prove it. If they could prove it, it would be an easy, pretty easy thing to do. Here's all this fraud. What are we going to do about it? And Democrats would be going like, good proof. Let's do something about it. But now they're going like, well, Kris Kobach, throughout his efforts to do this, has never proven a thing. But he's a good soldier and he's trying. And so we're going to put him on the next one.
Yeah. And they see this in larger existential terms. They see this as terms for the survival of white power in America. I mean, I think a lot of what this is about is a view that the country is changing in a way that doesn't benefit them. And this is kind of the last stand that they have to preserve the white supremacy that they believe in.
And this is why the great replacement theory is also another piece of this, which is that these immigrants coming in are just Democrats are bringing them in to replace white people.
Yeah. And that was such a fringe theory that has now been pushed into the mainstream of the party. And it's also, I mean, complete BS. But now you have Trump and Mike Johnson holding press conferences saying we're going to prevent non-citizens from voting. I mean, it's already illegal for them to vote. This is just the latest Republican boogie monster. And what it's doing is it's combining the, kind of their two favorite things, which is voter suppression with anti-immigrant sentiment. So they're trying to combine both of these things by basically saying, okay, the country's changing demographically because of all these illegals that are coming in and voting for Democrats. So therefore, we have to shut the borders. Oh, and we also have to prevent people from voting. So it's kind of the perfect thing for them to try to stand up all of the anti-democratic things that they want to do.
And our two big issues are abortion and democracy.
Well, I would argue that those are real issues based on what's happening in the country as opposed to a manufactured crisis.
Yeah, but does real actually beat not real?
Well, I guess we're going to find out.
I mean, I guess we are.
If you scare enough people, who knows? I mean, they've tried this before. They tried this with the migrant caravans in 2018. It kind of fell flat. But I understand why they're pushing it. See, people think of the immigration and voting as two separate issues. But for Republicans, it's basically the same issue. Because if they can raise concern about immigration, they can pass policies that make the country more white. And they can also build support for policies that keep more non-white voters from the polls. So it's a perfect thing for them to link because it all goes in support of the strategy of white power that they're trying to put in place more broadly.
Again, congratulations on Minority Rule. You've won some like very distinguished awards for your books, right?
Well, I would like to think that I've won some distinguished awards. I mean, I guess it depends on, you know, your definition of prestigious. But yeah, I mean, I won the Hillman Prize for magazine journalism for not for my books, but for my work overall. And my last book, Give Us the Ballot, was nominated for the National Book Critics Circle for nonfiction. It was one of those, it's an honor just to be nominated kind of things, right, Al?
Yes.
And hopefully this will win one. After people listen to this conversation, I hopefully am in the running for some more of them.
Yeah. And maybe you can get in there and kind of fudge the voting time.
Yeah, if nothing else fails, I'll just rig the ballot boxes for the National Books Awards.
Well, I hope you enjoyed listening. That beautiful music is by Leo Kottke, the great Leo Kottke. I want to thank Peter Ogburn for producing this podcast. We'll talk again next week.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
This episode is brought to you by the effortlessly scrumptious bite of Skinny Pop Popcorn. Imagine this: perfectly popped, endlessly delicious kernels, a symphony of just three simple ingredients: popcorn, sunflower oil, and a sprinkle of salt. No compromise, just pure snacking freedom. And hey, if you're up for a twist, dive into flavors like zesty white cheddar to sweet and salty kettle. Every bite's a delight, light and oh so tasty. Shop Skinny Pop now.
The early 2000s was a wild time for reality TV. There seemed to be an endless supply of shows that delivered entertainment for us, but trauma for children. I'm Misha Brown, the host of Wondery's podcast, The Big Flop. Each week on The Big Flop, comedians join me to chronicle the biggest pop culture fails of all time and try to answer the age-old question, who thought this was a good idea? We recently looked behind the scenes of what was really going on at Abby Lee Miller's dance studio. Abby's biggest misstep wasn't screaming nonsensical catchphrases or throwing chairs on television, but instead, she was choreographing financial fraud in plain sight. Join me to break down all the wild details of Abby Lee Miller's story. Follow The Big Flop on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to The Big Flop early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.